Hi, Dave Memory here. This is For the Record program number 1079, Surveillance Valley Part 5, Bubble Agents, subtitled Foxes Guarding the Online Privacy Hen House, Part 2. This is being recorded on July 16th of the year 2019. This program, obviously from the title, is the fifth installment about based on primarily a consummately important book. That book, Surveillance Valley, subtitled The Secret Military History of the Internet by Yasha Levine. As I have said before, I would not say this is the most important book I've ever read. I could not say that about any one book. But I will say without qualification that this is as important a book as I have ever read. And beyond that, I think that someone living in this time period, in this historical period, would find it difficult, if not impossible, to truly understand the world that we live in without reading this book. The internet, mobile technology, social media, these are the things that comprise our civilization. And the area where, proof that I suppose the ancient Greeks weren't far off in their understanding of the gods and how truly creative, unquote, they could be at times. This is where I have held forth for decades. And now the Silicon Valley, or as Yasha Levine has properly termed it, the Surveillance Valley is the very epicenter of our civilization. In our past programs, we have noted that the internet was not invented as a wonderful communication medium, but rather as an information weapon. Its purpose is counterinsurgency, and the focal point of that counterinsurgency development program overlapped with the development of Agent Orange, the lethal herbicide that was used in Vietnam with such, during the Vietnam War with such devastating effects not only on the landscape itself, but on the Vietnamese people and our own GIs on the ground. In this series, we have spoken about not only the internet itself, but surveillance. We have spoken about, and will take up at much greater length in our next program or two, the tech companies themselves. Their disclaimers, to the contrary, notwithstanding, they have been deeply involved with the government and intelligence community data mining from the very beginning. Their own epic data mining history and functions are inextricably linked with the counterinsurgency and surveillance foundation of the internet itself. The institutions that have emerged as champions of online privacy and the individuals, for the most part, are actually double agents, although many people, for example, with the Electronic Frontier Foundation may be sincere in their efforts. The fact of the matter is that the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other individuals and institutions that have ostensibly been champions of online privacy have in fact been fundamentally compromised. We have looked at the Tor project or the Tor network. That is arguably the best publicized alleged private or secure online tool to prevent government surveillance. In fact, it was developed by the very military and intelligence services that it is ostensibly to guard against. It is fundamental to the surveillance by those very services. It was financed by the government, the military, the intel community, and people like Jacob Applebaum, a devotee of Ayn Rand, and the Tor network itself had been underwritten not only by the Broadcasting Board of Governors, a CIA derivative, but its Open Technology Fund, which is a funding arm of the BBG, which is a CIA derivative. It is evolved from the CIA's broadcasting outlets. Obviously now, the Internet is arguably, well, not arguably, the Internet is the main broadcasting vehicle. It used to be radio and television, but now the Internet goes all over the world. We have looked at these things in the past. And again, I would recommend getting a hold of the book itself and also some information from For the Record 891 and 895. In this program, we are going to once again take up Jacob Applebaum, his financing by the BBG, read CIA, his promotion of the Tor network, the Tor network's adoption by WikiLeaks, and how, once again, the very privacy individuals and institutions who are supposed to be champions of civil liberties and privacy are, in fact, double agents. The basic paradigm behind or underlying the individuals and the institutions and technologies that we have been discussing and are discussing basically is a honey trap. The Internet itself is something like the operational equivalent of infinity. You have all these people and all these institutions using the Internet. So what they have done is they have created technologies such as the Tor network or the Signal app that we will talk about later or perhaps in our next program, depending on how much time we use here. And when promoted by people like Edward Snowden, when promoted by people like Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, when promoted by the Broadcasting Board of Governors and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they get the reputation of being secure against surveillance by the man. In fact, as Yasha Levine noted, they are the man. What basically they're doing is they're getting people to say, "Yoo-hoo, look at me, I have something to hide." And then the people at Tor, the people at BBG, the Open Technology Fund, etc., go, "Oh, okay, let's see what it is that you want to hide." Again, due to the limitations of time, I can't recap as completely as I would like to. Previous programs, the descriptions for those programs, and also, fundamentally, the book itself. Again, Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet by Yasha Levine, and by the way, I get no money from this, are the place to go to understand this. In numerous programs, For the Record 732, 745, For the Record 755, and 917, among other shows, we have talked about WikiLeaks and the fact that it is the antithesis of what it represents itself as being. Far from being a, quote, journalist, unquote, Julian Assange is a hacker. That hacking is a felony. It is a federal offense. It is the equivalent of mail tampering. And Julian Assange's hacker muse, so to speak, his hacker nickname was Mendax the Liar. And as I have noted, if what one wants to do is to, quote, speak truth to power, unquote, as they say, perhaps relying on someone who calls himself Mendax the Liar is a less than optimum selection. WikiLeaks has held forth on the Pirate Bay website that was financed in large measure by Carl Lundstrom, one of Europe's primary fascists, and he is part of an international fascist milieu, the best known member of which is David Duke. We've spoken about this in the past, and I will review that perhaps in the future. Suffice it to say that WikiLeaks, in addition to holding forth on the Pirate Bay website, was using the Tor Network, and Julian Assange's right-hand man, or one of them, in addition to Daniel Domscheit-Berg, whose book Inside WikiLeaks we examined at length, and for the record, 745. Jacob Applebaum, very closely identified with the Broadcasting Board of Governors, read CIA, became inextricably linked with WikiLeaks, and he helped adapt the Tor network for use by WikiLeaks. We touched on this briefly in our last program, and by way of continuity with our last program, we dig back into Surveillance Valley. Applebaum's association with WikiLeaks and Assange boosted the Tor project's public profile and radical credentials. Support and accolades poured in from journalists, privacy organizations, and government watchdogs. The ACLU partnered with Applebaum on an internet privacy project, and New York's Whitney Museum, one of the leading modern art museums in the world, invited him for a, quote, surveillance teach-in, unquote. The Electronic Frontier Foundation gave Tor its Pioneer Award, and Roger Dingeldine made in on Foreign Policy Magazine's Top 100 Global Thinkers for protecting, quote, anyone and everyone from the dangers of Big Brother. Roger Dingeldine, by the way, was the primary developer of the Tor network, which was financed by military intelligence and the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the BBG, read CIA.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Continuing with Surveillance Valley. As for Tor's deep and ongoing ties to the U.S. government, well, what of them? To any doubters, Jacob Applebaum was held up as living, breathing proof of the radical independence of the Tor project. Quote, if the users or developers he meets worry that Tor's government funding compromises its ideals, there is no one better than Applebaum to show the group doesn't take orders from the feds, wrote journalist Andy Greenberg in This Machine Kills Secrets, a book about WikiLeaks. Quote, Applebaum's best evidence of Tor's purity from Big Brother's interference, perhaps, is his very public association with WikiLeaks, the American government's least favorite website. With Julian Assange endorsing Tor, reporters assumed that the U.S. government saw the anonymity profit as a threat. But internal documents obtained through FOIA from the Broadcasting Board of Governors, FOIA, of course, the Freedom of Information Act, beginning again, but internal documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act from the Broadcasting Board of Governors, as well as analysis of Tor's government contracts, paint a very different picture. Those FOIA documents revealed that Applebaum and Dingeldine worked with Assange on securing, that belongs, quote, WikiLeaks with Tor since late 2008, and that they kept their handlers at the BBG informed about their relationship and even provided information about the inner workings of WikiLeaks' secure submission system. One more time, because this is really important. The Freedom of Information Act documents from the Broadcasting Board of Governors reveal that Applebaum and Dingeldine worked with Assange on securing WikiLeaks with Tor since late 2008, and that they kept their handlers at the BBG informed about their relationship and even provided information about the inner workings of WikiLeaks' secure submission system. Those should be in quotes. I'm going to interrupt briefly here. in addition to the fact that WikiLeaks was using poor, and that the BBV, again, a CIA derivative, was informed about the WikiLeaks, quote, secure submission system, unquote. Bear in mind, as we will see, that the Tor network itself, in addition to the fact that it is completely transparent to the very intelligence services that it supposedly guards against, because it was created and financed by those very intelligence services, it has some fundamental flaws that could enable anyone with reasonable internet skills to penetrate it. WikiLeaks was perhaps the most profound, and I would say probably successful, data mining operation in history, bearing in mind the worldwide promotion of WikiLeaks and the fact that it was on the Tor network, which is fundamentally compromised. It is a tool of the very intelligence services that it was supposed to guard against because it was developed by them. Okay? It is a surveillance tool. And given the fact that anyone with any reasonable internet skills, and the people at the Pirate Bay website are very, very, very skilled indeed, can use some very fundamental flaws in the Tor network to penetrate it, I think we can say without qualification that both the very intelligence services that were supposed to be locked out or frustrated by WikiLeaks were able to determine everything about everyone who visited the WikiLeaks site. They were data mining away. And bear in mind, when people went to the WikiLeaks site, they would click on this or click on that or do this or do that. And the intel services were monitoring every goddamn thing they did and databasing every goddamn thing they did. And so was the Fascist International. And there is indeed a Fascist International. Again, Carl Lundstrom, part of a network that includes David Duke. Daniel Freiberg, one of his close Swedish associates, is now engaged in a media enterprise with Spencer. One has a pretty good anti-Muslim Brotherhood website, but another one is one of the best-known alt-right guys off the top of my head. Anyway, Mr. Spencer, WikiLeaks was basically hosted by and transparent to the Fascist International. And with the fundamental flaws in Tor's network, accessible to someone with the proper internet skills, and the people at Pirate Bay have tremendous internet skills, it is the safest of bets that WikiLeaks was the most profound, widespread, and successful data mining or political data mining information in history. Organizations like Google and Amazon, which cooperate with all of these people, have tremendous commercial databasing and data mining. But for political and journalistic counterinsurgency data mining purposes, WikiLeaks was the most successful because it used the Tor network developed by the very intelligence services that it was supposed to protect against and accessible to the very Fascist International, which once again regained the White House and Congress with the assent of Donald Trump. Again, WikiLeaks, we can refer to the people who took WikiLeaks at face value and having worked to expose WikiLeaks and paid the price for that. I can say that is not a very fun thing to do, but the people who took WikiLeaks at face value, its users and its supporters might well be termed wiki suckers, because they were suckers. WikiLeaks was in all probability, the single greatest intelligence community and Fascist International data mining project in all of history. This last sentence again before we move on. the Freedom of Information Act documents reveal that Applebaum and Dingeldahn worked with Assange on securing WikiLeaks with Tor since late 2008, and that they kept their handlers at the BBG informed about their relationship and even provided information about the inner workings of WikiLeaks' secure submission system. Quote, talk to the WikiLeaks people, Daniel and Julian, about their use of Tor hidden services and how we can make things better for them, unquote. Tor developer Roger Dingeldahn wrote in a progress report he sent to the BBG, read CIA, in January of 2008. It turns out they use the hidden service entirely as a way to keep users from screwing up. Either it works and they know they're safe, or it fails. But either way, they don't reveal what they're trying to leak locally. So I'd like to add a new, quote, secure service, unquote, feature that's just like a hidden service, but it only makes one hop from the server side rather than three. A more radical design would be for the intro point to be the server itself, so it really would be like an exit enclave, unquote. In another progress report sent to the BBG 2 years later in February 2010, Dingeldahn wrote, quote, Jacob and WikiLeaks people met with policymakers in Iceland to discuss freedom of speech, freedom of press, and that online privacy should be a fundamental right. By the way, Jerron Jermas, another one of Julian Assange's top aides, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, a Russian-born Holocaust denier, who once said that it is the duty of all good Christians and Muslims to deny the Holocaust, made the arrangements for WikiLeaks to land on the Pirate Bay server, thereby enabling not only the intelligence services like BBG, CIA, to monitor what the WikiLeaks people were doing, but also the Fascist International, embodied by people like Carl Lundstrom, Daniel Freiberg, Mr. Spencer, and David Duke. Continuing, and bear in mind when I say BBG, that's the Broadcasting Board of Governors, read CIA. No one at the BBG raised any objections. To the contrary, they appeared to be supportive. We do not know if anyone at the BBG forwarded this information to some other government body, but it would not be hard to imagine that information about WikiLeaks' security infrastructure and submission system was of great interest to intelligence agencies. It's hard for me to read this without laughing. God, what a bunch of suckers people were. You know, and 95%, as John Loftus noted when I interviewed him in the summer of 2013, my first program back on the air, 95% of what Snowden spoke about and what was in the documents he released was already on the public record. And it's just amazing to me that people were saying, oh, wow, WikiLeaks, you know, in addition to all of the fascist connections. And Assange himself is probably a member of a mind control cult from Australia called the Santa Ketan and Park Association. Certainly was an online gangster. He was a hacker associated with the Fascist International, and now we know with the CIA. And again, the wiki suckers, the users and supporters of WikiLeaks, were part and parcel to the greatest, most successful data mining program in history. Whenever someone clicked on WikiLeaks, and whether they wanted to find liberal articles or conservative articles, the intelligence services were right there to get their data, and the Fascist International was right there to get their data as well. We can but wonder what use people like Cambridge Analytica may have made of the WikiLeaks data mining. But anyway, it is really hard to read this without laughing. One more time. About the use of Tor by WikiLeaks. No one at the BBC, read CIA, raised any objections. To the contrary, they appeared to be supportive. We do not know if anyone at the BBC forwarded this information to some other government body, but it would not be hard to imagine that information about WikiLeaks' security infrastructure and submission system was of great interest to intelligence agencies. Perhaps most telling was that the support from the BBG continued even after WikiLeaks began publishing classified government information and Applebaum became the target of a larger Justice Department investigation into WikiLeaks. For example, on July 31st, 2010, CNET reported that Applebaum had been detained at the Las Vegas airport and questioned about his relationship with WikiLeaks. News of the detention made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Applebaum's close ties to Julian Assange. And a week later, Tor's executive director, Andrew Luman, L-E-W-M-A-N, worried that this might affect Tor's funding, emailed Ken Berman at the BBG, read CIA, in the hopes of smoothing things over and answering, quote, any questions you may have about the recent press regarding Jake and WikiLeaks, unquote. But Luman was in for a pleasant surprise. Roger Bingelbein had been keeping folks at the BBG, read CIA, in the loop, and everything seemed to be okay. I can't imagine that it wouldn't. Again, they were data mining, the greatest data mining operation of all time. Not just for the very intelligence services supposedly victimized by Tor, WikiLeaks, etc., but by the Fascist International, which hosted this very operation. Luman was in for a pleasant surprise, by the way, after he was supposedly worried about this. Roger Bingelbein had been keeping folks at the BBG, Reeb, CIA in the loop, and everything seemed to be okay. Great stuff. Thanks. Roger answered a number of questions when he met us this week in D.C., Berman replied. Unfortunately, Berman didn't explain in the email what he and Bingelbein discussed about Applebaum and WikiLeaks during their meeting. What we do know is that Tor's association with WikiLeaks produced no real negative impact on Tor's government contracts. In 2011, contracts came in without a hitch. $150,000 from the Broadcasting Board of Governors and $227,118 from the State Department. Tor was even able to snag a big chunk of money from the Pentagon, a new $503,706 annual contract from the Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command, an elite information and intelligence unit that houses a top secret cyber warfare division. The Navy was passed through SRI, the old Stanford military contractor that had done counterinsurgency, networking, and chemical weapons work for ARPA back in the 1960s and 1970s. The funds were part of a larger Navy command control communications, computers, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance program to improve military operations. A year later, Tor would see its government contracts more than double to $2.2 million, $353,000 from the State Department, $876,099 from the U.S. Navy, and $937,800 from the Broadcasting Board of Governors. When I crunched the numbers, I couldn't help but do a double take. It was incredible. WikiLeaks had scored a direct hit on Tor's government backers, including the Pentagon and the State Department. Yet Applebaum's close partnership with Assange produced no discernible downside. I guess it made sense in a way. WikiLeaks might have embarrassed some parts of the U.S. government, but it also gave America's premier internet freedom weapon a major injection of credibility, enhancing its effectiveness and usefulness. It was an opportunity. By the way, in the context of all of this, remember a basic counterintelligence principle, which is that the most important thing for a good double agent to do is to make oneself indispensable to the effort. Over the decades, I have come to feel that civilian society really cannot effectively protect itself against the operations of a major intelligence service. I think, from a practical standpoint, the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi, basically just doing what is right, trying to maintain as much spiritual and personal control over oneself as one can, and recognizing that one might be killed for doing what is right, is the best stance to take. Not that you want to embrace martyrdom, but more about that perhaps in the future program. But basically, in connection with all of this, you know, the quote, internet freedom, as Yasha Levine noted, if Tor wasn't exactly the man, it was the man's right hand. Basically, in connection with the internet, which is a fundamental part of our world, most of my information now goes over the internet, although I still have some live radio broadcasts. But basically, you can run, but you can't hide. My counsel is don't try to hide. Just don't be an idiot. We're going to reprise something that I talked about back in 2010, namely the criticism of WikiLeaks from one of its founders, a guy named John Young. And he noted early on not only that WikiLeaks was funky, but that they acted like like a bunch of spies, his exact words, and that there was discussion from the beginning that this was some sort of honeypot. This was an intelligence or honey trap, an intelligence gambit in order to suck people into a trap. That looks like exactly what it was.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
From, for the record, 724 and 725. John Young, one of WikiLeaks' founders, and the link for this is in the program. Of WikiLeaks, John Young said back in 2010, they're acting like a cult. They're acting like a religion. They're acting like a government. They're acting like a bunch of spies. Parenthetically, exactly what they are. They're hiding their identity. They don't account for the money. They promise all sorts of good things. They seldom let you know what they're really up to. There was suspicion from day one that this was entrapment run by someone unknown to suck a number of people into a trap. So we actually don't know. But it is certainly a standard counterintelligence technique. One more time, these last few sentences, because it appears basically that John Young was absolutely correct. That's why I put his observations into the archives back in 2010. There was suspicion from day one that this was entrapment run by someone unknown to suck a number of people into a trap. So we actually don't know. But it is certainly a standard counterintelligence technique. And they're usually pretty elaborate and pretty carefully run. They'll even prosecute people as part of the cover story. That actually was talked about at Sunday's panel. They'll try to conceal who was informing and betraying others by pretending to prosecute them, unquote. I would note Julian Assange has now been indicted and extradited. He was indicted before. My guess is, as we looked at in For the Record 724, Assange appears to have been part of the aforementioned Santa Ketanin Park Association, a fascist mind control cult in which the members of the cult were tortured, subjected to various techniques involving LSD, sensory deprivation, and the children in this cult all had their hair dyed platinum blonde or white. They were given multiple identities and multiple passports so that one member of the cult could pass for another. If Julian Assange is actually convicted and sentenced to prison, my guess is that the person who actually winds up going into jail will be one of Assange's, quote, doubles, unquote, from the Santa Ketanin Park Association, and Assange himself will be given a new identity someplace else, or perhaps just gotten rid of now that he is no longer useful. Anyway, that is conjecture. Now, WikiLeaks is also inextricably linked with the operations of Ibby the Friendly Spook Snowden. Snowden made his run from Honolulu to Hong Kong with the assistance of Jacob Applebaum, funded by BBG, Reed, CIA, and a man whom we have spoken about before. Then he goes from Hong Kong to Moscow, courtesy of WikiLeaks, a WikiLeaks plane, one of Julian Assange's former girlfriends, and it is when Ibby the Friendly Spook Snowden, himself CIA, goes to Moscow that sounds the death knell of the reboot with Russia. Remember how Obama's State Department and Hillary Clinton were trying to reboot relations with Russia? Well, that got deep-sixed, courtesy of Ibby the Friendly Spook Snowden. It was his operation, inextricably linked with WikiLeaks and CIA, that sounded the death knell to the reboot with Russia and the beginning of the new Cold War. Now, in addition to the Applebaum WikiLeaks Tor Association, here comes Ibby the Friendly Spook Snowden, returning now to Surveillance Valley. Applebaum continued to draw a high five-figure salary from Tor, a government contractor funded almost exclusively by military and intelligence grants. But to the public, he was a real-life superhero on the run from the U.S. surveillance state, now hiding out in Berlin, the nerve center of the global hacker scene, known for its nerdy mix of machismo, all-night hackathons, drug use, and partner swapping. He was a member of the Internet Freedom Elite, championed by the American Civil Liberties Union and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, given a board seat on eBay founder Pierre Omidyar's Freedom of the Press Foundation, and occupied an advisory role for London's Center for Investigative Journalism. His fame and rebel status only made his job as Tor's pitchman more effective. In Berlin, Applebaum caught another lucky break for the Tor project. In 2013, his good friend and sometimes lover Laura Poitras, an American documentary filmmaker who also lived in the German capital in self-imposed exile, was contacted by a mysterious source who told her he had access to the crown jewels of the NSA, documents that would blow America's surveillance apparatus wide open. Poitras tapped Applebaum's knowledge of Internet systems to come up with a list of questions to vet the possible hacker and to make sure he really was the NSA technician he claimed to be. This source turned out to be Edward Snowden. From the start, The Tor Project stood at the very center of Snowden's story. The leaker's endorsement and promotion introduced the project to a global audience, boosting Tor's worldwide user base from 1 to 6 million almost overnight and injecting it into the heart of a burgeoning privacy movement. One more time, because this brings Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, a doctrinaire fascist, someone who wrote online in the summer of 2009 while stationed in Geneva, Switzerland for the CIA, in lambasting Social Security, and I have to attenuate this because we're on the radio. Well, he said the elderly, quote, wouldn't be effing helpless if you stop sending them effing checks and so they could sit on their A-blank-blank and lie in hospitals all day. Sounds like the Trump White House and the Republican Congress, doesn't it? Well, that's basically who this is. One more time. From the start, the Tor Project stood at the center of Snowden's story. The leaker's endorsement and promotion introduced the project to a global audience, boosting Tor's worldwide user base from 1 million to 6 million almost overnight, and injecting it into the heart of a burgeoning privacy movement. In Russia, where the BBG and Dingledine had tried but failed to recruit activists for their Tor deployment plan, use of the software increased from 20,000 daily connections to somewhere around 200,000. During a promotional campaign for the Tor Project, Snowden said, quote, without Tor, the streets of the Internet become like the streets of a very heavily surveilled city. There are surveillance cameras everywhere, and if the adversary simply takes enough time, they can follow the tapes back and see everything you've done. With Tor, we have private spaces and private lives where we can choose who we want to associate with and how, without the fear of what that is going to look like if it is abused. The design of the Tor system is structured in such a way that even if the U.S. government wanted to subvert it, it couldn't, unquote. That is, it really is priceless. And I find myself experiencing a lot of schadenfreude. You know, I remember when I spoke about Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, pointing out that he was a fascist, that he worked for the CIA, and that his operations basically helped to discredit the Obama administration, bringing about the new Cold War, and helping to usher in Donald Trump. When Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, basically, little more than a Nazi lawyer, held their party to celebrate their receipt of the Polk, the prestigious Polk Award. One of the people in attendance there was Andrew Auerheimer, a.k.a. Weave, the web architect, or the Internet architect for the Daily Stormer, who himself appears to have been behind the hacks of the Macron campaign in France, which were then attributed to Russia. These people are the opposite of what they have been represented as being. And if one takes the time to examine the relevant documentation, that not only becomes obvious, it becomes absolutely incontrovertible. But as Mort Saul, the brilliant political comedian and one of the people who inspired me to do what I do, observed in his autobiography, Heartland, how many lies before you belong to the lie? And there's also an old Turkish proverb, he who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
We're going to wrap up this series, a show or two or three down the line, and we're going to talk about what happened to Yasha Levine, because he got roasted for writing this book. He got the Jim Garrison treatment. He is, thankfully, still alive. He doesn't appear to have been harmed physically, but boy, has he been the target of an awful lot of fresh fertilizer. More about that, however, in future programs. I love it. His Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, who in the summer of 2009 decided, hey, I've got to do something to help people out. This while he was stationed in Geneva, Switzerland by the CIA, whose subsidiary organization, the BBG, helps to finance the development of Tor. He says, with Tor, we have private spaces and private lives where we can choose who we want to associate with and how, without the fear of what it is going to look like if it is abused. The design of the Tor system is structured in such a way that even if the U.S. government wanted to subvert it, it couldn't, unquote. Now, this should be accompanied by a soundtrack with little pastel blue and pink cherubim hovering about, playing the rites of spring on their celestial harps. I mean, this is so grotesque. But, you know, that's the world we live in. Continuing. Snowden did not talk about Tor's continued government funding, nor did he address an apparent contradiction. Why the U.S. government would fund a program that supposedly limited its own power. Whatever Snowden's private thought on the matter, his endorsement gave Tor the highest possible seal of approval. It was like a hacker's medal of valor. With Snowden's backing, no one even thought to question Tor's radical anti-government bona fides. In an earlier political period, Daniel Ellsberg, the leaker of the Pentagon Papers, became what he is to this day, which is a hero to the so-called progressive sector. In fact, in past programs and in a Food for Thought post, I have noted from the book The CIA is Organized Crime by Douglas Valentine that Daniel Ellsberg himself has profound connections to CIA from Surveillance Valley. Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary whistleblower who in 1971 leaked the Pentagon Papers, backed Tor as a powerful weapon of the people. Yeah, no doubt, like Daniel Ellsberg himself. In For the Record programs 733 through 739, and again in For the Record 1025 and 1026, I spoke about the so-called Arab Spring, really the Muslim Brotherhood Spring, as an intelligence operation with a number of different goals, the most important of which was to install the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization that was allied with the Axis in World War II and jumped to Western intelligence, CIA in particular, at the end of the war, and whose primary economic theoretician, the 14th century thinker Ibn Khaldun, is viewed by the World Bank as the first advocate of privatization. Basically, the corporations love the Muslim Brotherhood because, again, their economic doctrine and the doctrine of Ibn Khaldun is part and parcel to the neoliberal economics that the globalized corporations endorse. And we're going to review from For the Record program 1026 the role of Jacob Applebaum and the Tor Network and the Broadcasting Board of Governors, etc., in the Arab Spring. Once again, turning to Surveillance Valley. Within weeks, massive anti-government protests spread to Egypt, Algeria, Oman, Jordan, Libya, and Syria. The Arab Spring have arrived. In Tunisia and Egypt, these protest movements toppled long-standing dictatorships from within. In Libya, opposition forces deposed and savagely killed Muammar Gaddafi, knifing him in the anus after an extensive bombing campaign from NATO forces. In Syria, protests were met with a brutal crackdown from Bashar Assad's government and led to a protracted war that would claim hundreds of thousands of lives and trigger the worst refugee crisis in recent history, pulling in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, the CIA, the Russian Air Force, and special operations teams, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS. Arab Spring turned into a long, bloody winter. The idea that social media could be weaponized against countries and governments deemed hostile to U.S. interests wasn't a surprise. For years, the State Department, in partnership with the Broadcasting Board of Governors and companies like Facebook and Google, had worked to train activists from around the world on how to use internet tools and social media to organize opposition political movements. Countries in Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America, as well as former Soviet sites like Ukraine and Belarus, were all on the list. Indeed, the New York Times reported that many of the activists who played leading roles in the Arab Spring from Egypt to Syria to Yemen had taken part in these State Department training sessions. Quote, "The money spent on these programs was minute compared with efforts led by the Pentagon," reported the New York Times in April of 2011. But as American officials and others look back at the uprisings of the Arab Spring, they are seeing that the United States democracy-building campaigns played a bigger role in fomenting protests than was previously known, with key leaders of the movements having been trained by the Americans in campaigning, that's an organization with a capital A and a capital C, organizing through new media tools and monitoring elections, unquote. The trainings were politically charged and were seen as a threat by Egypt, Yemen, and Bahrain, all of which lodged complaints within the State Department to stop meddling in their domestic affairs and even barred U.S. officials from entering their countries. An Egyptian youth political leader who attended the State Department training sessions and then went on to lead protests in Cairo told the New York Times, quote, "We learned how to organize and build coalitions. This certainly helped during the revolution," unquote. A different youth activist who had participated in Yemen's uprising was equally enthusiastic about the State Department social media training. Quote, "It helped me very much because I used to think that change only takes place by force and by weapons," unquote. Staff from the Tor Project played a role in some of these trainings, taking part in a series of Arab blogger sessions in Yemen, Tunisia, Jordan, Lebanon, and Bahrain, where Jacob Applebaum taught opposition activists how to use Tor to get around government censorship. Quote, "Today was fantastic, really a fantastic meeting of minds in the Arab world. It is enlightening and humbling to have been invited. I really have to recommend visiting Beirut. Lebanon is an amazing place," Applebaum tweeted after an Arab bloggers training event in 2009, adding, "If you'd like to help Tor, please sign up and help translate Tor software into Arabic," unquote. Activists later put the skills taught at these training sessions to use during the Arab Spring, routing around internet blocks that their governments threw up to prevent them from using social media to organize protests. Quote, "There would be no access to Twitter or Facebook and some of these places if you didn't have Tor. All of a sudden, you had all these dissidents exploding under their noses, and then down the road, you have a revolution," unquote. Nasser Wadabi, W-E-B-B-A-B-Y, a prominent Arab Spring activist from Mauritania, later told Rolling Stone. Wadabi, who had taken part in the Torah Project's training sessions and who had translated a widely circulated guide on how to use the tool into Arabic, credited it with helping keep the Arab Spring uprisings alive. One more time. Wadabi, who had taken part in the Torah Project's training sessions and who had translated a widely circulated guide on how to use the tool into Arabic, credited it with helping keep the Arab Spring uprisings alive. Quote, Torah rendered the government's efforts completely futile. They simply didn't have the know-how to counter that move. And again, Torah is a tool of the intelligence services. And after the success of the Arab Spring, the U.S. government began financing various technologies to promote, quote, internet freedom and, quote, openness, unquote. We'll take this up at greater length in our next program, but noting here, the motivation for this expansion came out of the Arab Spring. The idea was to make sure the U.S. government would maintain its technological advantage in the censorship arms race that began in the early 2000s, but the funds were also going into developing a new generation of tools aimed at leveraging the power of the Internet to help foreign opposition activists organize into cohesive political movements. The BBG's $25.5 million cut of the cash more than doubled the agency's anti-censorship technology budget from the previous year, and the BBG funneled the money into the Open Technology Fund, a new organization it had created within Radio Free Asia to fund Internet freedom technologies in the wake of the Arab Spring. More about this. From behind this hip and connected exterior, BBG and Radio Free Asia built a vertically integrated incubator for Internet freedom technologies, pouring millions into projects big and small, including everything from evading censorship to helping political organizing, protests, and movement building. With its deep pockets and its recruitment of big-name privacy activists, the Open Technology Fund didn't just thrust itself into the privacy movement. In many ways, it was the privacy movement. And again, the Open Technology Fund is a subsidiary of the BBG, which is a CIA derivative. We'll go into this at much greater length in our next program because we are almost out of time. Seeing how things develop, I think that we should maybe have a word about what is, as I speak, on January 16th, the focal point of much of the news in this country. AOC and Sekhat Chakrabarty are doing exactly what they promised to do and what I stated unequivocally was the goal of the far right that appears to work behind them. They have started a war within the Democratic Party, and now Donald Trump has turned the squad of four, as I call them, the gang of four, into political martyrs. Maybe talking about them as sort of the domestic equivalent of the Arab Spring. Sekhat Chakrabarty in particular may very well be a Peter Thiel protege. He went from the largest hedge fund in the world, Bridgewater Associates, to basically being the factor that underwrote AOC, because she and Sekhat Chakrabarty want to purge politics from the influence of big money. Yeah, right. Just basically the same application of the same double agent methodology, although I think AOC herself is probably clueless, to that was evident in the Arab Spring and in everything else. However, this will have to wait for our next program. program, because this concludes For the Record program number 1079, Surveillance Valley Part 5, Double Agents, Foxes Guarding the Online Privacy Hen House Part 2. This is being recorded on July 16th of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.